Joining us now is Dr. Daniel Kinka, who is the director of Rewilding for American Prairie. We appreciate you being a part of This Green Earth this morning. We have a lot to discuss. You have a lot of work happening there at American Prairie. You have this multi-million acre nature reserve. So first, why don't you tell us more about American Prairie, a little bit of its history, what your goals are, and also about yourself and what your job is there at American Prairie.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you very much for having us. American Prairie started in 2001 with the goal of creating one of the largest nature reserves in the lower 48 states, preserved in perpetuity for people and for wildlife. And in the last 20 plus years, we've been essentially buying ranches in and around a large national wildlife refuge when they come up for sale and we can afford to purchase them, stitching them together along with a lot of the public land that's out there to create a space for public access and rewilding and wildlife restoration and functional ecosystems again. In that time, we have gone from 0 acres to over 600,000 acres of land that we own and land that we lease from the federal and the state government, restored bison to a herd of almost 1,000, brought beaver back into the creek, restored beaver habitat, brought prairie dogs and other ecosystem engineer back into the landscape. And that's my job at American Prairie as the director of rewilding, is to think about how to get wildlife back in meaningful abundance to support functioning ecologies while sharing that space with the general public.
And when you say functioning ecologies, why is it important that we're reintroducing some of these species and making sure they're a part of that ecosystem?
First and foremost, this is part of our heritage as Americans, right? We have a, I think, a right to experience the wildness that this country was heir to. And not that long ago, we were talking about 200 years ago, when anybody could have experienced something like an American Serengeti, where you could have come to the Great Plains, the Northern Great Plains of North America, and experienced those thundering herds of bison and elk and bighorn sheep and pronghorn and wolves and grizzly bears and prairie dogs and sage grouse, et cetera, et cetera. We lost that. But it wasn't that long ago, and we have the potential to restore that. Now, the deeper level, and as an ecologist, the kind of thing that underpins that abundance is functioning ecologies, right? The plains are a dry place. They are grasslands because they don't get as much rainfall as landscapes that are forested. But that doesn't mean that they're not capable of production. They are capable of supporting this enormous abundance. But there's a kind of a chicken and an egg problem, right? In order for the prairies to be truly abundant, they need the wildlife to drive the ecological processes that in turn support that wildlife abundance. Now, I mean, we could get really geeky and technical here, but basically the idea is wildlife abundance is something that should be shared and enjoyed, and it benefits us directly and indirectly by kickstarting these ecosystems into action, making sure that they are diverse and that they function the way that they're supposed to provide us ecosystem services and the natural beauty and the functioning ecologies that we all rely on.
And can you give us a better idea of exactly where this is located in Montana?
Yes, of course. So we're located basically, if you can picture the state of Montana and find the middle of it, we're just up and right from the middle. So there's an existing 1.1 million acre National Wildlife Refuge, the Charles M. Russell National Wildlife Refuge. And in a very, very simple elevator pitch, American Prairie is essentially trying to make that National Wildlife Refuge bigger by stitching private lands and other public lands together to make a larger space for wildlife. Essentially, the goal being to triple the size of the wildlife refuge, not as it exists, but as it functions as a space for public access and wildlife abundance.
So when thinking about an ecologically functioning ecosystem, I think most people have a good sense of what that means in, say, forests. Most people understand the difference between just what an old growth forest looks like and a young forest. But can you describe a little bit what an old growth, I know that's not quite the right term, but an old, intact short grass prairie ecosystem looks like? You explain the animals a little bit, but can you paint us a broader picture?
Yeah, absolutely. And Seth, I actually don't think that's a bad way to think about this. We can think about old growth grasslands, even though that's not terminology that most of us use typically, but the native grasses to the prairie have very deep roots. They may only grow 12 or 18 inches above the ground, maybe less in a dry year, but those roots extend feet and feet down underground. There's also an enormous diversity of both plant life and then the soil microbiology that kind of exists between the root systems of those plants. So there are truly old grass, old growth grasslands, but you don't see most of it. The forest is largely above ground in the sense that we've come to recognize it. The grasslands are largely below ground when we're talking about old growth grasslands. That diversity of plants, and specifically what we think about as kind of a patchy mosaic, right? So this isn't even. The prairies are meant to be kind of thick and ungrazed over here and short and heavily grazed over here with different species compositions on prairie dog towns than outside of prairie dog towns. And that diversity of habitat types is what supports the biodiversity of wildlife above ground. That's how you get big, huge, abundant herds of large mammals and large carnivores and large scavengers and all manner of migratory birds. And then, of course, if we think about things like climate change, what these grasslands are doing, what those thick, diverse, deep root systems in the prairie are doing is sequestering carbon the same way that a forest does, but in a way that's a bit more resilient, right? When forests burn, they release most of their carbon back into the atmosphere. When grasslands burn, it's just the above ground part that burns, and where most of that carbon and biomass is underground is preserved. So while they don't store as much carbon as a forest might, we can think of it as better like long-term storage. So this concept of an old growth grassland is actually very meaningful both in terms of mitigating climate change and reversing species loss and bringing back biodiversity.
Now I want to ask a question about how plant life and animals interact and kind of shape and adapt to each other in some of these old growth prairies. You work both on rewilding bison, beaver, and prairie dogs. Can you talk a little bit about how reintroducing those animals to the prairie ecosystem actually changes that prairie ecosystem?
So this gets a little complicated and very visual, but let me try and break this down for you all and your listeners in a way that's understandable. So imagine a prairie is a kind of a lawn, right? This isn't one species like in your front yard, but like many, many dozens, hundreds of species of plants, but a lawn nonetheless, right? And just like the lawn in your front yard, it gets mowed in a sense, not by you, not with a lawnmower, but by bison, by prairie dogs, by things like wildfire or controlled burning. All of these things impact the structural diversity of the prairie, right? So not the species of plant that are out there, but how tall they're growing. Because on a prairie dog town, the prairie dogs are keeping that grass clipped very, very short. With bison being allowed to do what bison do naturally, they're grazing in a way that is not systematic, not even, not the way that we would typically manage cows, right? They graze some areas very hard, they miss other areas for years at a time, and then of course, historically, you would have had burning interplaying with that as well. So you imagine a quilt, right? A kind of a patchwork quilt, but one that changes over time. So there's a short patch of grass here, a tall grass of patch here, something that just burned over here, something that got grazed a little bit maybe last year, but not very much this year. And all of those are essentially different habitat types. And the classic way we think about this in terms of biodiversity in ecology is with grassland birds, right? So let's just say bird A needs to have a nesting spot where it feels safe and can rear its young, where the grass is very tall and it can essentially hide in that grass. Well, now you need your tall grass patch in order to support bird A. But there's also bird B, who has evolved to be cryptic and hide, ironically almost, in a place where the grass is grazed very, very short. Their eggs might actually be kind of speckled and look almost like a burned cactus or something like that. These birds specialize and need to nest where it is heavily, heavily grazed. And so bird B requires this other patch. And traditionally, the way that we've managed the Great Plains is take half, leave half. We subdivide the entire thing with barbed wire fence. We graze the cattle to take half of the production each year, half of the grass that grows, and leave the other half for the wildlife. Well, that's good for some birds, but the birds that need the ungrazed or the heavily grazed, they diminish, they decline. And that's exactly what we've seen for decades now. And so that's what we talk about in terms of like the ecological processes that are brought back by these grazers, whether they're bison or prairie dogs or even insects, right? That we need to keep that grassland moving, that patchwork quilt shifting constantly, because that expands the space for biodiversity. Basically, more grazers grazing in a wild way creates the habitat that we need for more birds. And of course, it's not just birds, it's all manner of species as well. That habitat needs to be diverse to support biodiversity, and that habitat diversity is supported by these grazers in many cases, wild grazers.
So if we look back at the history of this land and we are talking bison, what was that picture way back in the 1800s? And what is it that you want it to look like today?
Yeah, I think there's two parts to that question, right, Claire? So like, what did it look like? It looked like any number of old cowboy Wild West paintings that you can see by artists like Charlie Russell, right? The listener should Google When the Land Belonged to God, famous painting by a famous prairie artist, right? Where you can see a thundering herd of bison crossing the Missouri River, coming back up on the plateau with sage grouse and wolves in the foreground. And this is probably a pretty good depiction of what the plains looked like historically. Of course, it leaves out the human history. There were indigenous peoples here for thousands of years, coexisting with this wildlife, which is often not depicted in those paintings. But that's a little bit of what you would have expected historically. Now, what American Prairie is trying to do is not necessarily wind back the clock. The goal here is not to recreate exactly what Lewis and Clark saw, but to restore that abundance of wildlife that drives those ecological processes that I've been talking about. So it's not a world where there are no roads and people are expected to live in teepees, but it is a world where those thundering herds of bison are able to cross the landscape and do what they're meant to do as ecosystem engineers, with people in modern tents and modern RVs coming and seeing that bioabundance, that wildlife abundance, the thing that they should have inherited and we kind of accidentally messed up 200 years ago. And one other point that I think is worth mentioning, because we take this for granted as Americans, but the 1800s may feel very long ago, and certainly it was a different world back then. But when we look at rewilding globally and what they're trying to restore, in parts of Western Europe, it hasn't been quote-unquote wild in 2,000 years. And they're needing to bring back, you know, novel types of things to make ecosystems function. We are very lucky and fortunate in the Western Hemisphere, in North America, in the Northern Great Plains, that what was wild was very, very recent. That makes it very possible to bring it back, and to bring it back in the most natural way possible, which is just to say these animals, by and large, are already here. We just need more of them. And most of this land is already public. So why not bring back that wildlife abundance, that wildness, and then invite the general public to come enjoy that as well.
And can you walk us through what it means to have bison be classified as livestock? Because you're talking about wild bison. So can you share with us what that classification is and how that works?
Yes, and thank you for that question, because we've been dancing around this a little bit, but this is critical. Bison are the nation's mammal. They are on the badge of every single park ranger that you or anybody else will meet in a national park. They are an important wild animal, but almost nowhere today are they allowed to be a wild animal. It's kind of weird. In most of Montana, outside of Yellowstone National Park, bison are considered livestock, not wildlife. Now, we can get into the details of legality of what that means, but setting that aside for a moment, as strange as that may seem to me and to the listener and to you, it provides an opportunity for an organization like American Prairie to do, quote unquote, rewilding, wildlife restoration, legally and within the existing mechanism. Bison may not be legally classified as wildlife, even though we might choose to think about them as wildlife and certainly want them to be wildlife in the sense of ecological actors. But with the system that we have, for better or worse, American Prairie has been able to say, we will buy bison. We will pay taxes on bison the way a cattle producer would. We will put them to work on the landscape as the ecosystem engineer, as the keystone species, as the nation's mammal. But we will do this under a completely different framework. Wildlife belong to the public. And as a non-governmental organization, American Prairie has no authority to manage the public's wildlife. That is done for us by public servants. But bison, being private property, being livestock, can be owned by an organization like American Prairie and can be put to use as grazers on private land and public land if you are legally operating and holding the lease to those public lands. This is typically Bureau of Land Management land or state lands as well that are typically used for grazing. Now these quote unquote grazing public lands can be used to support ecological restoration through the restoration of bison, not as wildlife, but bison as livestock. If you came to visit American Prairie today, you would see the bison and it would not feel anything like a ranch. But underneath what you see and behind the scenes, what is happening is a very sophisticated, very well-managed bison ranch that Bison Ranch is just simply serving the needs, the desires, the wants of the ecosystem first and production later. And this is essentially what, this is what we're facing now.
Earlier this year, the Bureau of Land Management canceled grazing permits for bison that I believe American Prairie held in Montana. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about both the impacts of that decision on your restoration efforts and just give us a little context about and your thoughts on why the Bureau of Land Management might make this decision.
I mean, I can't speak for the Bureau of Land Management in this case and what they're thinking, but essentially what this came down to was on May 8th, the Bureau of Land Management issued its final decision, which revokes American Prairie's bison grazing permits. So I was just talking about how we have for 20 years legally and within the defined system been able to restore wildlife processes, ecosystem processes through grazing bison as private property on public lands. We operate legally and we've done that through, you know, by following all the rules that have been set for us and any other cattle producer using the public lands. What is happening now is essentially the BLM is changing the rules basically to say that what we are doing with our bison is somehow no longer eligible for access to these public grazing lands, despite these being the public's land and the nation's mammal that we're talking about, following all of the pre-existing rules and actually benefiting the habitat in a documented, empirically measurable way in many cases. And yet the BLM is saying this is no longer going to be an option for American Prairie because we are not using our bison for quote unquote production. Not use them for production despite sending hundreds of bison from American Prairie to other conservation ranches throughout the country, many of them tribally run initiatives to restore bison. Not being considered production despite donating tens of thousands of pounds of meat to food banks and local communities to support those lifeways. Not being considered production despite the tourism economy that American Prairie is generating and the people that come and buy groceries and gas and snacks and everything else on their way out to see American Prairie's bison. But it is not production in the typical sense that cows are production on the public's lands. And this is the crux of the issue. And that's what we're facing right now.
So I've heard quotes in news articles from ranchers in Montana talking about the issue of bison restoration. And some of these quotes that I've read have a sentiment and an expressive view that the prairie lands are there to generate food for humans and that bison just don't fit on this landscape in this current time anymore. And I was wondering if you could respond to that comment, that general sentiment that I've read about, and how that impacts and interacts with your restoration efforts.
Yeah, and with respect to my neighbors, because I live out on American Prairie on an old ranch, and in some cases the people that you're quoting are, in fact, my neighbors, if not my liberal fence neighbors, people that don't live too far away. With respect, I don't think that's an accurate read of what the public lands are for. But more specifically and more pragmatically and perhaps more diplomatically, this is not thinking in terms of an abundance framework. In a sense, as an ecologist, this isn't my preferred framing, but in a sense, the prairies have always provided abundant food source for people. For thousands of years, native people lived primarily off of bison that were produced on abundant grasslands, an animal that co-evolved with the system, co-evolved with the drought and fire and the other animals and the grasses themselves in a way that supported lots and lots of human lifeways, produced a lot of food, if you want to think about it that way. In a sense, this is not substantively different than what American Prairie is trying to do now. We see bison as a potential food source that can feed people either through bison donations or even bison harvests that take place at American Prairie. This is not incompatible. And to the extent that we're talking about lands that American Prairie owns outright and we're just simply choosing to graze them with bison, or lands that American Prairie, at least until very recently, has legally operated and been able to graze, these public lands that we have the leases for, benefiting the landscape. Well, I mean, among all the other things that that does, I would say this is a type of food production, and certainly one that doesn't impact the neighbors on the other side of the fence. We're not asking them to do things differently with their cattle. I'm not entirely sure why the existence of American prairie in the bison is seen as an existential threat to the cattle producing community that, again, are in many cases my neighbor. I take the point for what it's worth, but there is no sense of competition here. And in fact, the kind of global movement towards rewilding is increasingly leaning towards this idea that, like, these are not mutually incompatible goals. Wilder rangelands can actually support more and better cattle production at the same time, whether they're separated by a fence or not separated by a fence. So I just don't think this plays out philosophically or in terms of the available science that we have.
Daniel, unfortunately, we do have to wrap up, but if people wanted to learn more about American prairie, about this conversation that we've just been having about the BLM's new passing of that law, can you share with us where they should go, how they might be able to get involved?
Yes, absolutely. And thank you for that. And thank you again for having us. The best way to stay involved is to visit us at our website, AmericanPrairie.org. You can find a landing page there that's called Bison Belong. This is an evolving situation. It changes. It's dynamic. And so the best way to follow along is to follow our updates. There's a number of other NGOs and tribal entities that are also tracking this closely. And I would encourage your listeners to follow that as well. And just a reminder briefly that these are public lands, which is to say that they are your lands. And you have an ability to weigh in on this, and not bison notwithstanding, as private property, all the other wildlife that are out there are also public property and belong to you and belong to the listener. And they are right and encouraged to speak up about how they'd like to see their public lands and their public wildlife managed for their benefit and the benefit of their children's children.
Yeah, and this last minute on a path of hope, what are you seeing at American Prairie that keeps you hopeful for the future?
I see the land getting wilder in a way that benefits everybody. I've watched bison for 7 years grazing on a pasture that for decades before that had cattle, and watching the creek, the heavily degraded creek, ironically named Beaver Creek, start to recover and actually have beaver come back into the system. I've watched that passive rewilding happen just by having bison on the landscape. I've seen my colleagues get up every day with shovels and trucks and plant willows in the creek and dust prairie dog towns so that they don't die unnecessarily from non-native diseases. And all of this is bringing back wildlife and wild spaces. And I've seen my cattle producing neighbors lean on their fence and admire bison on the other side of the fence and what that means for the landscape that their fathers and their grandmothers have stewarded for generations. And that gives me hope. It's getting wilder. A lot of this other stuff is noise, but rewilding is possible. Hope is possible. And your listeners are very welcome to come and see this for themselves.
Well, thank you so much. It's Dr. Daniel Kinka, who is the director of rewilding for American Prairie. AmericanPrairie.org is where you can go to learn more. Thank you so much for being a part of this Green Earth today, Daniel.
A pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to This Green Earth. If you have an idea, we'd love to hear from you. Give us your ideas and topics, your storylines. It's thisgreenearth@kpcw.org. You can also find us wherever you listen to your podcast. If you like the show and you learned something new, make sure you leave a review. And we'd appreciate it if you click 5 stars.